Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. Today is Friday, February 10th, 2017. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary. Our Noah Rothman is off on a jaunt to Ukraine, I don't know, Crimea, somewhere, a stan somewhere. We'll read about it next week.
Very mysterious. I don't know if we don't have, you know, the details. This, who knows what's afoot?
I know he could be violating the Logan
Act.
Exactly. We don't know. That's Abe Greenwald, our senior editor. So it's just the two of us today. Dizzy. I've described my feelings over the past week as though I'm permanently trapped on a tilt-a-whirl machine at an amusement park. Because the news and the pseudo-news and the fake news and the real news and the Trump news comes at sort of hourly or 90-minute intervals, and it is just impossible to stay calm and sober and rational, and even to sort of try to view the entire workings of the current political moment from a distance perspective when you just don't know whether 5 minutes from now there's going to be some insane piece of news. So I have a list here of some of the things that have gone on since the last time we talked. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld the stay of Trump's executive order limiting immigration and visas from 7 predominantly Muslim countries. The news came that National Security Advisor Michael Flynn lied when he said that he hadn't talked to the Russian ambassador to the United States during the period between the election and the inauguration. Somebody's dropping dirty dimes on Flynn and the intelligence community, releasing audio tapes to prove that he did in fact have these conversations, which must have come from sort of secret taps and stuff. The president had a conversation with President Xi of China in which he affirmed the U.S. support for the One China policy after the surprising and very unexpected moment during the transition when he had a phone call with the Prime Minister of Taiwan.
President
of Taiwan, and seemed therefore to be calling the One China policy into question. Kellyanne Conway, following a tweet by the president complaining that Nordstrom's had pulled Ivanka Trump's clothing line from its stores due to poor sales, advocated everyone going out and buying them, which is a clear violation of federal law. Then she said Trump was behind her 100%. Then the press secretary said that she had been counseled on the matter. Now you read that the president is mad at Spicer for saying that she was counseled on the matter, since he's perfectly happy with the fact that she did it, even though it violates federal law so severely, I believe, that the quite lily-livered Utah Congressman Jason Chaffetz, who runs the Government Accountability Committee of the House, actually sent a letter to the White House expressing his distress at the Ivanka plug by Kellyanne Conway and demanding that there be an investigation and that she be held to account, which was very surprising because Chaffetz has 17 times in the last 3 weeks said that he didn't care about this potential violation of something, and he didn't care about that. But this finally came out. And then, of course, in the middle of the week, during the confirmation of Senator Jeff Sessions to be Attorney General, during the final debate on the floor of the Senate before the vote, Senator Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, silenced liberal Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, claiming that she was violating Senate protocol by attacking another senator directly, thus making her a martyr. Clearly, McConnell is angry at Warren and other Democrats for having voted against his wife, Elaine Chao, to be transportation secretary, which is really not a very good reason to make a giant political scene with somebody of the other party. And I think there are about 17 other things that I haven't mentioned, Abe, that also have come up in the last 3 days. And I don't know about you, but I can't take much more of this.
Well, here's the thing. Big stories are coming fast and furious. They're coming at an ever-increasing pace. But thank God, they're all good stories. They're all really, they're all great, reassuring stories about the public trust and the future that we're heading towards. No, I cannot take it either.
No one can take it. And Ben White of Politico last night said something like, "I would give a kidney for a normal news cycle." You know, this can't go on. We are all going to die.
And yet,
he said.
And yet, it's hard to see how it stops going on because this is the administration's MO. It's almost beyond sort of trying to figure out how much of it is intentional and how much of it is accidental. But chaos is certainly reigning. And what's interesting also is that so now with this flurry of crazy stories. The focus has shifted away from the anti-Trump movement a bit. It's shifted away from the protests. It's shifted away from their supposed, and in fact sometimes evidenced craziness and extremism. It's back on the administration acting out and seemingly violating norms if not laws.
Well, the whole question about the new White House style that Trump is promulgating. Is what are its long-term effects on the larger political system, the national political system, the national political conversation, and national behavior in general? In a blog post earlier this week, I said that in some ways, Trump was sounding like Michael Corleone, you know, that when he told Bill O'Reilly that, what, we're so innocent, that he was sounding like Michael Corleone in Godfather 1 saying, now who's being naive, and Michael Corleone saying, you know, we're all part of the same hypocrisy to a senator in Godfather 2, and that one doesn't wish one's president to sound like Michael Corleone, who is the greatest fictional character crime boss and a person that one does not wish one's leaders to either emulate or to represent as though he is the dominant figure in the free world. That, to me, is the most distressing aspect of all of this.
And I have to add, you know, it's bad enough that he sounds like Michael Corleone, but he sounds like Michael Corleone without Corleone's sense of guile. I mean, you know, it's one thing to be completely cynical about the evil in the world and therefore decide to play the game. It's another to sort of speak that way and then get nothing for it and then sort of, you know, cave on issues and have your policies be overturned because you're completely incompetent.
Right. Well, two aspects of this, one of which is, let's say we go to the Ivanka Nordstrom story. So last week, the big story was that Ivanka had separated herself from all of her businesses and no longer ran them and no longer had anything to do with them. So why this week is he tweeting angrily at Nordstrom's for pulling Ivanka's clothing off the shelves? She doesn't work for Ivanka Trump Inc. anymore. So it's weird. It was a weird thing to do. It came out of nowhere, aside from being extraordinarily inappropriate for the president to be targeting an individual business based on his anger at its behavior toward a family member. She is supposedly has no interest in this anymore. So that's part of it is, it's like, what? Why is he talking about this? What madness is this? And then if we go to the really serious issue, right, which is the executive order. So here's the other thing about whether or not everyone is being dragged down into a kind of spiral to the bottom. So a lot of people that I trust say that the Ninth Circuit's decision and that indeed the original judge's decision in Seattle are horror shows that, you know, the original judge in Seattle didn't properly cite any reasons or any precedents and even, you know, accepted things that should not have been accepted, and that the Ninth Circuit's decision is so sloppy that it seems to suggest that it would be unconstitutional for the president to impose any kind of these restrictions in case future immigrants and illegal immigrants were to have their due process rights injured. So in other words, there's no harm at the present, but there could be harm in the future, in theory, and indeed toward people who are in this country illegally, which is astonishing. And one wonders whether the incredibly badly drafted executive order then leads inexorably to incredibly badly drafted and considered legal opinions intended to stay it, thus forcing the Supreme Court into the position of bringing some measure of sanity to this discussion that we have literally no idea whether the Supreme Court will in fact do.
I mean, you know, people who I trust are suggesting that this will be overturned. I suspect they're right. The
Ninth Circuit's stay of the executive order.
Right. I suspect the larger question about whether if and how we get back onto higher ground in terms of argument and opposing viewpoints is much more sort of dangerous and open-ended question.
So there are two. There's the serious and the unserious, let's say, in terms of the more extreme arguments that are being made against Trump. So I would say that they come in the camp of the David Frum view and the far to the left of David Frum view. So the David Frum view is that that Trump is a kleptocrat and that his purpose in becoming president is to enrich himself and his family, and that he does not believe in political niceties, and he has no interest in checks and balances or any restraints on the presidency because he will judge himself a success in the manner of a Latin American potentate who, at the end of the day, has tens of billions of dollars more in the bank than he had in the beginning. And according to Frum, in an interesting characterization, he says, people are saying that there are all these checks and balances. There are no checks. There are no balances. All there are people who have to maintain their constitutional responsibilities to stand up, to speak against, to, you know, seek indictments, to investigate, to do stuff like that. It's an interesting characterization. You know, nothing has risen to that level. This is all speculative. And then you have the Reichstag fire analogy. So that is, you know, a lot of Germans and German politicians and conservative German politicians thought that Hitler was a clown and thought they could control the Nazis, even though the Nazis were getting more and more powerful. And then, you know, they sort of thought they could install him and he could take over and they could control him. And then he stages the Reichstag fire in 1933 and he essentially destroys all of his allied parties and takes everybody under one wing, and that, you know, if Republicans normalize Trump by not, you know, facing him down and arguing with him and, I don't know, trying to impeach him or whatever, that we're headed toward the Reichstag fire. Now, aside from everything else, which is that, you know, Weimar Germany was a very weak system. It was only 11 years old when the Reichstag fire happened, and you know, it was a terribly corrupt system in the first place, and there was no 240-year history of checks and balances and the like. The central problem with the Reichstag fire analogy is that there has been the Reichstag fire. Before the Reichstag fire, there had never been anything like the Reichstag fire in which a leader used, you know, a staged event to consolidate his power and destroy his enemies in a time of mass media. But we have the example of the Reichstag fire, so that everyone is saying, look out, there could be a Reichstag fire, which means that you can't have a Reichstag fire, I think.
I think you're right. It's like after 9/11, storming the cockpit became sort of obsolete because now that was sort of understood.
Yeah, you could close the barn door. Right. Once it's like the, not to use a very, I'm going to use a very, very elevated analogy of the famous Bugs Bunny Daffy Duck cartoon where they're both in vaudeville trying to one-up each other. Mm-hmm. And Bugs Bunny keeps getting applause and Daffy Duck gets nothing. And then finally Daffy Duck swallows gunpowder and lights himself on fire and blows up. Yes. And his ghost is flying to the heavens. And Bugs Bunny says, "Oh, my God, Daffy, they love it. You did great. This is amazing. And do an encore." And Daffy Duck says, "I can only do it once." So, you know, you can only do the Reichstag fire once if you could do the Reichstag fire in the United States. But you know, that we're 3 weeks into this administration and we're talking about the Reichstag fire just because Trump is somebody who has no interest in constitutional niceties. It's a stretch to go from no interest in constitutional niceties to, like, having a deliberate plan to consolidate power, destroy the democracy, and then, you know, take over the world and set up concentration camps.
I agree it's a stretch, but here's the thing that the... I tossed it off casually because there's a second part to it. What the kleptocrat sort of argument doesn't really take into account, though, is Steve Bannon, who is an ideologue and who has, at least in his own mind, if not objectively revolutionary ideas about what he wants the American state to look like and how he wants to get there. And they are, and these are destructive ideas, and they are, you know, they are cataclysmic and transformational ideas. Now, I don't know that that either transforms into a Reichstag fire, but it's... It adds an element that's deeper and additionally troubling to just the simple bumbling kleptocrat version of right. things.
So the challenge over the next 4 years, there's there are two issues here, right? So there's the bumbling incompetence, people who've never done anything before and don't know what they're doing and won't take anybody's advice. And then this kind of unstable person at the top who is an X factor as opposed to being a stabilizing influence. And ordinarily, like the president, is a stabilizing influence in the sense that he is constantly calibrating, you know, how he's doing, what his feel is with the people, and not trying to push things too far one way or another, like a, you know, like a... like the number one product in the world. If you're Coke, you know, you don't want to just change your formula every 5 minutes. And when the one time you did, you made a huge mistake. You make tiny calibrations in your positioning and you change your advertising every 5 or 10 years because you don't want to, like, upset the apple. That's the classic model. Trump is a new model, so he's a sort of revolutionary, destructive model at the top. The problem, so that's the bumbling problem is that bumbling is sort of built into an impulsive to a world in which somebody is impulsive and, you know, either ignorant or uninterested in how the system has functioned before him and likes to bully and threaten as a means of control, of controlling his enemies or his friends. Then you get to the Bannon thing, which is not bumbling or something like that, but which is there is some kind of larger ideological plan which has to do in Bannon's mind with arresting the decline or the suicide of the West, some of which is internal, that is moral decay and rot from the inside by a too soft society, by a terrible system, by the fact that the rich are just getting richer, and by, you know, bad socialist ideas, and then some of it from the outside, which is the threat from Islam, radical Islam, and forces that want to do us harm, including secularization and, you know, liberal ideas. And the problem there is that it's not clear that he knows how to put this program into practice. But it shouldn't be a political program. It's a cultural program. It's a controversial cultural program. It's an argument that, in fact, you can't say that his side won. That's not why Trump... I don't think anybody really thinks that's why Trump got elected. You know, he got elected because the white working class is feeling abused and wants to get some of its own back, and some of that is included in the Bannon critique, but not all. And then they didn't win the popular vote nationally, so they're still, even if every person who voted for it, it's not a majority of the country that wants to enact some kind of radical program to, you know, crush Islam wherever and whenever it is, and to extirpate it from the country and to sort of impose a new religiously inspired Western idea of how the world should be. And so each of these is bad in its own way. Together, they create a really horrifying cocktail of incompetence, and then like the spine being a set of, you know, somewhat important, you know, with a residue of very important ideas about moral decay, but with a program that is even, you know, that is often quite disgusting, in fact. So
correct. I mean, if you look at just the collapse of now the relationship between the administration and the media. On the one hand, this is happening because you have Bannon calling the media the opposition party. This is a dearly held conviction in his mind that they stand for the prolongation of everything he wants to see torn down. I mean, destroyed. On the other hand, it's happening because Trump himself simply has an emotional response to being called out by the media, and he snaps out. He lashes out every time he's called upon, and the combination is degenerative, and we are left with this hash of nonsense that you sort of, you know, recollected at the beginning.
Well. So then you have the good working order of the federal government. So we don't have an entire cabinet confirmed. They have 5,000 executive branch posts, which have not been, you know, political jobs, which have to be filled. They want to make sure that everybody who is in those jobs, you know, sort of like follows the party line. But the party line is not clear. Is the party line just personal allegiance to Trump, or is it some kind of allegiance to this Bannonite view of the world, or what? And, you know, so the devil's bargain of Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan and the House and the Senate Republicans, who are in a majority here, is they stick with Trump. They take it on because they really have a chance. These are sort of conventional, somewhat conventional, very policy-driven Republicans, particularly in Ryan's case, who want to enact reformist policies that will, they believe, benefit the country and reverse some of the sort of like the onrush of sort of liberal European socialist style ideas that Obama helped enact. But he's going to get in the way of that. He needs them to pass some of this stuff. In particular, he's going to need the Congress to pass some version of the repeal and replace of Obamacare, which was his number one promise. And he steps into the debate every 3 days and throws a monkey wrench in the works by saying, no, I don't want that. No, I like this. You need to do that. All, you know, this is an incredibly delicate, complex maneuver. Obama jammed the federal government's hands into areas of health care and the way that the entire national system is handled that requires delicate extrication and rebalancing and replacement of certain incentives with other incentives and things like that. And then you have this blunderbuss at the top, you know, sort of like complicating matters. Same thing with tax reform. What does he need? What does Trump need to be a success? He needs there to be a greater degree of economic growth than Obama showed, that has a greater spread in the overall national economy so that it reaches down from the top 1%, you know, down into the middle class, lower middle class, and the working class. That requires tax cuts. That requires deregulation. That requires a lot of stuff that have to be handled very delicately, and delicacy is not his strength.
And I think we should
put it mildly.
Just occurred to me. I think we should brace ourselves for another horrible possible moment. After some time, when jobs numbers are starting to be released, after that reflect the implementation of Trump policy, and he doesn't like those numbers, What will the president inevitably tell us about the numbers that we're getting from our own government?
Well, that's an interesting question. Can the president himself say that his own government is issuing fake news?
Yes.
In other words, like there are enemies within the bureaucracy. Right, he can. And, you know, the question, again, is that or some other things. And, again, like worldwide crises that we haven't even begun, we can't predict, but which will erupt, because they do. What are Republicans going to do when they have to go into some form of opposition to him? So they have avoided the Russia issue simply by avoiding it. You saw, as I said, Jason Chaffetz found it necessary to say something about Ivanka Trump. But, of course, that's a tiny little thing. That's a momentary spasm, an impulse that doesn't – it's not like a larger policy thing. But, you know, they're not going to want to go against the president of their own party, who is popular in many of their districts, and, you know, therefore invite his wrath and, you know, possibly invite primary challenges and things like that. And on the other hand, if they don't, there's going to be no way for them to get themselves out, provide any deniability to them for terrible things that happen, which all politicians really want. Is if it's not their fault, they shouldn't have to, like, own, you know, something terrible. And I just think we're sitting here looking at this after 3 weeks and saying, terrible things are going to happen. Maybe good things are happening. Maybe good things will happen. You know, maybe tax cuts will happen. Maybe some of this deregulatory stuff will, Gorsuch will be confirmed, and maybe there'll be another Supreme Court, and that will be good. There'll be good things for, you know, in conservative eyes. But terrible things are going to happen from this. Chaos is a terrible way to run a railroad.
Well, and also
trains are going to crash into each other.
Well, and also when you're the president. Style is content, you know, and actually all your actions have consequences, and things happening isn't just a description of policies you enact. Things happening is covers his tweets and his attitudes, and that those are terrible things happening, actually, mm-hmm. that are taking their toll on
right.
the country.
Well, we were talking about the phone call between Trump and President Xi of China, and how they finally had a phone call after months, and Trump affirmed that the United States accepts the notion that there is only one Chinese nation, even though, meaning that we don't formally recognize the existence of Taiwan, which is, of course, preposterous, as Taiwan is an extraordinarily prosperous first world nation and a democracy and a country that we do enormous amounts of business with and that we spend a lot of money defending and all of that. But so we don't accept its existence, but otherwise. So yeah. this is the fiction that we maintain because we decided to start it in 1979 when we made peace with when we recognized China, and then went for it. So he's going to be tough on China, right? Trade war with China. We're going to have a trade war with China. We're going to impose a 45% tariff on Chinese goods. This is the end. We make terrible deals. First phone call with Xi. What happens?
He comes out. Everyone describes it as a lovely phone call, and he comes out and says the U.S. reaffirms the one China policy.
Yeah, so he sucked up.
Yeah,
In the end, the first time he has a conversation with China, he sucks up.
And let's not forget, this is on top of formally pulling out of the Trans-Pacific
Partnership,
which our pulling out of that now gives China more room to make its own trade rules with its own partners and cuts us out of the picture. The interesting thing.
So effectively, having run essentially as a kind of trade warmonger with China, he is now somehow greenlighting Chinese domination of the Far East.
That's right, exactly right. You know, but as someone who would welcome the renunciation of the one China policy, in his hands, I'm sort of happier to go with the status quo.
Right.
You know, that's you don't even want too much change.
Well, it's an interesting issue for people who are interested, who are concerned about the fate of Israel and are friends of Israel and all that, which is, you know, it's an incredibly delicate management question about what sorts of policies the United States should or should not either advocate or try to block or not block at all or be quiet about. in relation to Israel's conduct, particularly in you know, when it comes to the Palestinians. And, you know, mostly what one wished for when the administration of Barack Obama was hostile was benign neglect, like just don't talk, don't involve yourself, leave it alone, let it manage itself. This is a sovereign country. We don't have any interest in the outcome here. And, you know, your whole idea that the Israel-Palestine problem is creating instability in the Middle East has been disproved by everything that's gone on over the last 8 years of the Arab Spring and Syria and everything, none of which has anything to do with Israel. But instead, you have the possibility of Obama kind of, again, blundering into excessive activism in relation to this and thus limiting the freedom of mobility of the dance that Bibi Netanyahu and others have to do in order to maintain their own political system, their own political futures, the balance between Israeli democracy and Israeli security and the threat from the Palestinians and the division in the Palestinian body politic between the Palestinian Authority and Hamas. And, you know, what if Trump just says, I like this, or I don't like that, or I don't like the other thing? And again, it's like this giant foot, you know, the foot of Colossus just slamming down and changing the balance of everything for years solely as the result of pique or, you know, a momentary spasm of interest and then loses interest. So in that sense, the status quo is preferable almost everywhere.
Right, because he's also, you know, people say the best argument for Trump is that he represents this sort of bipartisan critique of the last, I don't know, you know, 16 years of American leadership, and that he's, but in truth, he can undo understandings and norms that go far longer into history than that, and right. and that's a tremendous danger. You know, Bret Stephens, the Wall Street Journal columnist and commentary contributor and friend of ours, he had an interesting tweet on the China One policy announcement, which was that, look what China sort of got by ignoring him. You know, China—they didn't really respond aggressively to his initial faux pas or whatever his initial talking to Taiwan was, and they didn't respond aggressively to all his bluster either. And they got exactly what they needed and wanted out of him. I mean, there may be a lesson for that more broadly in dealing with him and sort of figuring out his psychology.
Right. Well, so to sum up, in many conversations with many people of a conservative persuasion, some of them voted for Trump happily, some voted for him grudgingly, some didn't vote for him at all. I am hearing very little enthusiasm or optimism about the current condition of things. People are defensive and saying they hate the left and they don't like the media and it's all the media. But 3 weeks of this has been demoralizing and disheartening, as Judge Gorsuch said.
That's yet another news item.
Yeah, that's right, though. Yeah. I barely even mentioned. Right.
What I'm hearing from his supporters, there's an amazing thing where his success is now completely unfalsifiable, because if he does something bold and a little crazy and reckless, like the travel ban, crazy just because it's not serious and the way it was enacted, that's a great sign that he's keeping to his word. He's doing what he can. He's finally someone who gets in office and does what he said he would do. If he does something like now acknowledge that we will go forward with a one China policy, they say, look, see, isn't that great? It was an opening bid. You thought he was crazy. He's fine. He's in keeping with it. So there's no room in their minds for faulting him. He's good on both ends.
Right. And they defend him and they attack liberals and all that. But I'm saying that there's a certain juice that's already, after 3 weeks, drained out of this.
Absolutely.
A certain kind of like, boy, this is really going to be great. You just can't, you know, one of the things about the conservative temperament, not, you know, American conservatism isn't really conservative in the way other countries' conservatism is, but if the one thing that it has in common is the notion that the praising someone for shaking things up, we don't want things to be shaken up. You know, that's why I said I feel like I'm on a tilt-a-whirl. That is not the right that is not the right thing to convey. It doesn't convey strength. It doesn't convey solidity. It doesn't convey permanency. It conveys instability, discomfort, nausea, you know, a need for a barf bag. I mean, this is not the way. And so it's one thing revolutionaries like to see things burn, you know. Steve Bannon is a revolutionary, but I'm not, and most conservatives aren't. I mean, they hate liberals. A lot of people really hate liberals. But, you know, Trump isn't just hating on liberals. I mean, if he were just hating on liberals, that would be a real sort of interesting fight, you know. But that's not his game. He's, like, trying to get Ivanka Trump's clothing line back in Nordstrom. I don't know what that has to do with the ideological battle between capitalism and socialism.
Exactly. And what is this great fictional you know, platonic Trump voter out there think of that? This the forgotten white man out of work. Yeah. Think about, you know, Trump's war on Nordstrom's and Kellyanne Conway's sort of, you know, hawking.
Yeah, see,
Ivanka's.
In the end, I don't think this is my point. I don't think any of this matters. I say that all they have, all that he has to get they think he has their back. Mm-hmm. Fine. Well, if after 4 years their lives aren't better, they're not going to think he has their back. Just another one of those people who just came in and made promises and gave us nothing.
Right.
Or something like that. So he has to deliver. And as I say, part of the difficulty of what we're seeing here is that delivery, that delivering on his promises, even with a compliant Congress, is going to be all but impossible if he makes it impossible for there to be a good working order in which things can happen in the country. Including, by the way, problem with the executive branch, which is, you know, all these policies that are enacted and the Congress passes legislation, they then have to be administered by people who work in the executive branch. And if they're not confirmed and if they don't have employee and all of that, then there's no point in anything.
Right. And, you know, and his the travel ban, for example, he could have written it up and implemented it in a way that it could have been.
Look, the Ninth Circuit decision says very plainly, oddly enough, despite its being so irrational and crazy and all that, it says, you know, you could just, one possibility here is you could take the travel ban and you could redraft it in a manner where it is not patently, in our view, it does not raise constitutional questions.
Right.
And God knows where this is going to lead, by the way, because either the Supreme Court is going to have to grant cert and hear the case fast, which is what it ought to do, because this is actually what the Supreme Court exists for, is to adjudicate differences between lower court, either between the presidency and the Congress, which is ultimately what this is. This is a question about whether or not the president's actions fulfill the rules and regulations as set out in the National Security Act of 1952 and the Immigration Acts, or whether he is overreaching and whether he has, you know, whether he is essentially claimed emergency powers at a time where he is not demonstrating that there's an emergency or something like that. It's a question of who has the plenary power here. Does Congress have it or does the president have it? And I've heard it two ways and seen it two ways. And in the end, Congress always has plenary power over that which is legislated. The president may not, you know, however, if it grants the president wide latitude, then the question is how wide is the latitude? The Supreme Court should hear this next week, if it can, because it's a national emergency and all this. And you know that since we haven't heard from them today, we don't know what's going to happen. So if they don't, then the stay is stayed. And maybe he just uses it. Maybe it's fine. Maybe he'll take it. And so he can go, aha, you know, when like a guy, you know, when a Muslim goes into a 7-Eleven and shoots out a camera, then he can say, "You see,
I tried.
He needed the bag to blame the judge."
Right.
You know.
Right.
I mean.
Right.
So politically, it could be perfectly fine for him to just let things lie and say he did what he could, and the rotten system of so-called judges, you know, stymied him.
I don't think he likes the humiliation, though. I mean, I think he having nothing to do with security policy and what he thinks that the executive order will actually achieve, I don't think he likes the record showing that he didn't get his way.
Well, he apparently this week, the final thing we can talk about is that the Solicitor General job at the Justice Department was offered to a Washington lawyer named Chuck Cooper, legal pro, whom I know a little bit, knew a long time ago, who was a very able person, a very smart person, who was somebody who has argued many cases before the Supreme Court. And for whatever reason, it's not clear, he's not either not taking the job or they decided not to offer him the job. This is a very significant thing because if this case comes before the Supreme Court, somebody has to argue the case before the Supreme Court, the Solicitor General of the United States or some person of his standing or someone has to be the person to make arguments before the Supreme Court, to coordinate the briefs, to get the right information in place. If they don't have a good Solicitor General, that's bad. So right there you see the other incompetency of making these huge moves without having any infrastructure to back it up.
Right, and they build on themselves these bad moves, and right. And the whole thing sort of topples over.
Yeah. Well, so sorry to depress you guys, but that's the end of our podcast. The one thing I can say is that if Noah Rothman had been here, he would not have entered, I believe, any note of cheer to combat with us here.
Right. He's usually more down on these things than we are.
That's right. Yeah. So at least you were spared the total Spenglerian crisis that we could have given you, and just this kind of general sense that, a couple more weeks of this and, I'm going to have to go to the Himalayas and meditate for 4 years because this is just too much. So for Abe Greenwald, I'm John Podhoretz. This is Commentary Magazine's podcast, Commentary Magazine, the 72-year-old monthly of intellectual probity, analysis, criticism, commentary, and political discussion. Join us at commentarymagazine.com where you get some free reads, and then we ask you to subscribe. $19.95 for a digital subscription, $29.95 for an all-access subscription, including our beautiful monthly magazine, in your mailbox every week. Give it a shot. Join the hundreds of thousands of people who are reading us every month and the tens of thousands of people who are listening to this podcast, as you already have, and keep the candle burning.